Well, welcome. Tonight we're talking about faithfulness and how to maintain it, and then when it's destroyed, how to restore it. In other words, tonight we're talking about affairs, and I realize that this is a delicate topic, and in fact, we didn't tell you, it's one of the few topics probably ahead of time that we didn't tell you that we were going to talk about that this week, and here, this is just a personal fear. My fear is if we told you that we're going to be talking about affairs this week, that half of you would say, well, that just doesn't really apply to me. I'm not going to go. And the other half would go, oh, that really applies to me. I'm not going to go. And so I would walk in and I'd be teaching to an empty room. And so if it feels like I sprung it on you, I apologize for that. There's a reason for that. But it's an important topic for us to cover. And it's an area, affairs are an area that impact every single one of us. And so we're going to talk about affairs and how do we prevent them, and when faced with one, how do we recover from it and put a marriage back together? Because the reality is every single one of us have been impacted by an affair at some point, at some level in our lives, right? We know somebody who's had an affair. Maybe we grew up in a family and one of our parents or both of our parents had affairs, and we understand the devastation that is to a child and to a family. Maybe you have been on the betrayed end, and you know the pain of being betrayed by a spouse who has an affair. Maybe you've been on the other side of it, and you've been the one who has had the affair, and you've been the betraying spouse in that. And now you have come to the point where you understand the pain and the turmoil that has caused you and the people that you love the most. Karen and I were early in our marriage, when we got married. We were young. We were both fairly strong believers, and we just assumed that this would not even be an issue for us. That wasn't, you know, an affair wasn't even in the realm of possibilities. And so we entered into marriage kind of just pretty well assured this was not going to be something that we ever needed to even talk about or deal with it and that kind of stuff. And then about 5 years into our marriage, we began to notice that a number of prominent Christian leaders, people that we trusted and you know, lived under their teaching from a distance, some people on television, people like that, people that we knew of, those kinds of things. But some prominent Christian leaders that we would say, you know, they certainly, if anything, their faith was stronger than ours, and they were more grounded and well-versed in Scripture and well-meaning, you know, all those kinds of things. We noticed that several of those Christian leaders had affairs and destroyed their marriages and tanked their ministries because of that. And that really hit Karen and I hard because we really looked up and respected those people. And one of the things that we noticed was as we began to hear some of them kind of be transparent and tell their stories is they would say things like, I never saw it coming. I never thought this would be something I would have to deal with. I never thought this would happen to me. And then they tell the story that everybody tells, which is, you know, one thing led to another. But those phrases, we never thought this would happen to us. I never envisioned that this would be something that would happen to me. That really hit us hard because that's exactly what we were saying. And I remember having the conversation with Karen where we said, no, wait a minute, time out. Because if those people who are really strong believers and people we really respect, if they say it would never happen to us, and then it does, then who are we to think that somehow we're stronger than they are, that if just by us being, you know, so set on the fact that it would never happen to us and saying this would never happen to us, that somehow we're safe. And so we did a shift in our thinking at that point, and we actually came to the conclusion that maybe it's wiser not to think this could never happen to us. But maybe the wise approach for us would be to say, it could absolutely happen to us. Why wouldn't we approach, you know, a life and marriage and ministry and all those things under the assumption that, well, if it could happen to them, it could certainly happen to us. And if that's true, then rather than just, you know, going around confident that it won't happen to us, maybe we should be putting things in place to make sure it doesn't happen to us. And so that became, you know, a radical kind of change for us in how we approach marriage and has, you know, for the last 35 years, as we have approached marriage, with this idea of course it could happen to us. And let's be real intentional about putting safeguards in place so that it doesn't, all right? Tonight what we're going to do is look at, if you remember when we looked at the meeting each other's needs around the book that Willard Harley wrote called His Needs, Her Needs, the top five needs for men, the top five needs for women. If you remember when we did that session, we said that the subtitle of the book was Building an Affair-Proof Marriage. The idea that you take the top five emotional needs for men, the top five emotional needs for women. If any one of those isn't met, being met in a marriage, that marriage is ripe for an affair. That those emotional needs are so strong in the soul of inside of each one of us that if they're not met in our marriage, we will kind of even subconsciously and unconsciously look outside the marriage to have those needs met. And so Harley said that's kind of the basis for preventing an affair. And then Harley and his daughter wrote a follow-up book to that called Surviving an Affair. What do you do if? What do you do when? And the number of couples that he worked with, the number of people that I have met that have had affairs and are trying to, you know, the difficult process of putting a marriage back together, they wrote a book on that. And a lot of the content for tonight comes out of that book. So tonight we're going to talk about affairs. Why do people have affairs? How do they get started? How should they end? You know, how do you prevent them? And then how do you recover from them? How do you restore a marriage? And this will be helpful stuff for us, regardless of where you are currently in a marriage or relationship, because I think God will put each one of us in positions of influence around other people who are struggling with this very thing. And I think the stuff that we cover tonight will be applicable to each one of us, but will also be great tools for us to have as we work with other folks that we love. So let's start by talking about the anatomy of an affair. Where do affairs come from? How are they? How do they get started? And we start with this idea that Harley talks about, that affairs do not develop out of a lack of moral values. So it's not just people that don't have any morals that end up having an affairs. People begin to change their value systems to accommodate the affair. When people find themselves going down the path toward an affair, even people of high, strong faith and high values begin to rationalize and begin to accommodate their morals and their values so it aligns with the affair and it rationalizes the affair. In fact, the reality is most people, if you took a survey, almost everybody believes in being faithful in marriage. You know, if you were to take a survey, how many of you people think faithfulness is a good thing in marriage? You know, there aren't many people that would go, no, I just don't think that's really very important. Everybody thinks faithfulness is really important in a marriage, okay? And so that value alone and having values and having morals and having faith alone isn't enough to safeguard us when faced with the temptation of an affair, all right? So the first thing that we know is that not all affairs are sexual. Most of us, as soon as we think affairs, we think sexual relationship, and that's not always the case. Emotional affairs have the same roots and require the same steps for marriage to recover. Okay, so a common kind of an affair is an emotional affair, a relationship that doesn't reach the level of sex, but it has almost all the other elements of a relationship. Okay, that's an emotional affair. And if you are in or have been in an emotional affair, that's not sexual, the reality is to recover from that and to put a marriage back together, because it can have devastating effects on a marriage even though it's not sexual, the process of putting the marriage back together is exactly the same, whether it's an emotional affair or a sexual affair. Okay, when we look at this continuum of emotional attachment in affairs, there's a whole continuum from one end to the other, okay? On the one end, we have one-night stands, okay? And that where a one-night stand has little emotional attachment, although there can be great emotional consequences as a result of it, but it doesn't start from a level of emotional attachment. It's usually a pattern of behavior. A one-night stand is usually not a one-time thing for people. It can be a pattern of behavior in their past. It can have to do with previous partners or prostitutes, but it's an area of acting out of the affair, of the marriage, being unfaithful in the marriage, in an area that has almost no emotional attachment with it, okay? It's almost always just sexual. At the other end of the spectrum, there is an intense emotional attachment to the point where people are in affairs with somebody that they would almost describe as being soulmates. That there is a deep emotional attachment, a deep relationship with that person. But it usually began as a friendship. Usually, and we'll talk about how the one thing leads to another, but it's usually a relationship that began with a friendship and then moves to meeting one or more of the other person's emotional needs. And it doesn't begin with sex, but sex makes the bond tighter, as we talked about when we talked about what happens in our bodies and minds through sexuality. And so the sex in the affair makes the bond even tighter. It doesn't start as a sexual affair, but it usually ends up there, okay? Most affairs, though, lie somewhere in between. But regardless of where you are on the continuum, the way to end the affair and the way to restore the marriage is the same. We need to go through the exact same process. And whether it was sexual or just emotional, okay, the process is exactly the same. And so let's talk then about the development of an affair. Harley says, a friendship develops into an affair when a man and a woman have feelings for each other and express those feelings towards each other. Which is really intriguing because I think most of us at, you know, a blink response would be, we would think that, you know, when does a relationship become an affair? Most of us would think, well, when you have sex. But Harley says, no, it's way before that, and it's when people express feelings. And so it goes through this kind of a process. It starts as a friendship. Sometimes it could be, you know, people that are working together. It could be neighbors. A lot of times affairs begin with two couples that are friends, and there's a cross-pairing in that kind of a relationship. But it doesn't start out with the intention of being an affair. It usually just starts in some kind of a platonic work or friendship relationship. And then it begins moving, the relationship begins moving, and there is some level of meeting needs. And we talked about that with the five needs of men, the five needs of women. In your handout, you see those listed. And especially primarily where maybe there is a deficiency in one of those needs being met in the marriage, and we begin looking outside of the marriage. And in the friendship, even it may even start out, you know, innocently with an emotional need of conversation for women, or the emotional need of admiration for men. Where, there is no intent of it becoming an affair or moving down the line towards sex, but people that are good friends begin to share conversation and share admiration. And that if that meets that emotional need, it begins to trigger feelings, okay? And those feelings can get triggered, and that can move to the point where you begin actually having feelings of attraction and feelings of love for the person. You never set out that way. And this is why people say, you know, I don't know how we got there. It was just one thing that led to another. Well, this is the one thing that leads to another that you have to pay very close attention to, or you'll end up down here and go, how did I get here? Well, there's a pretty logical progression that gets you there. And so when enough of those needs continue to be met, I can begin having feelings of attraction for the person and begin to think, I think I'm falling in love with that person, okay? Not realizing that it comes from what we just talked about, all right? And then we get to a point where one person, you know, kind of gets up the courage and, you know, there's kind of some, you know, there's a lot of kind of feelings going back and forth and some banter, and you kind of suspect that the other person feels, but you're not quite sure. And so at some point, you risk it all and you sit the person down and say, you know, I just have to come clean. I have to be really, really honest. I'm just really attracted to you. And not knowing if that's going to, you know, blow the whole thing up right there. But then the other person looks back across the table and says, you know what? I feel exactly the same way. And Harley says, when one person expresses feelings of love and attraction for the other person, and the other person reciprocates and says, me too, that's when the affair begins. At that point, the affair is off and running. The expression of feelings and the relaying back of the exact same feelings, okay? And then it often moves, and sometimes very quickly, to the bonding that happens with the sexual and emotional bonding or that happens with sex, all right? And so not all affairs start with unmet needs. This is kind of the common progression of the one thing that leads to another. Some people have fairs as a, you know, it could be an acting out of a pattern or of an issue from the past. It could be because of the past or other issues in the betrayer's life. So there are other things that can lead to an affair, but this is probably the most common thing that happens and becomes the thing that we need to pay very close attention to and put up safeguards against making sure that doesn't happen, all right? Once the affair is off and running, now we move into the stage of maintaining the affair. And to maintain an affair, a secret life must be created. Because if you think about it, you know, I still have my normal life over here that I'm trying to create the semblance that everything is as normal as it's ever been in my life, my family, my work, my marriage. But over here, I've started an affair. And so to maintain the affair, I've got to create this secret life over here that is completely separate from my normal life. Okay? And so what we find is that people who have never had a history of lying now find themselves to be masters of deception. And often the first lie is the lie when they're confronted and they say, I am not having an affair. You know, you seem to be spending a lot of time with him. Is everything okay? Yes, everything's okay. Quit accusing me. You know, I am not having an affair is usually the first lie that people have that maintains the secret life, all right? Now, the more that couples kind of in their day-to-day normal life anyway lead lives that are separate from each other, that are independent from each other, the easier that deception becomes to maintain, the easier the secret life is to create. So if one of them travels for work, you know, if one of them is gone easily 3 or 4 days a week, and so there are these large chunks of time that they're not together, that becomes an easier place to maintain a secret life, you know? Or maybe that they don't travel, but maybe, you know, he bowls every Tuesday night with the guys and she plays cards every Thursday evening with the girls. And, you know, whatever that is, he stops on the way home for a drink every night after work. But there are these blocks of time that are kind of naturally built into their lives that are separate from each other, independent from each other. That becomes fertile ground for developing a secret life in an affair, all right? Now, I chuckle at that because I think, you know, in Karen and I, the way we've kind of set up our lives, if either one of us was to suddenly be away from home or away from each other more than normal and the other person didn't know exactly where they were or what they were doing, that would be very out of the ordinary for us. And that would raise yellow flags and that would precipitate a few questions when we got home. Because very seldom is there anything in our lives that the other person isn't, you know, intimately aware of or schedules that do. There aren't blocks of time that we're just kind of naturally away from each other that would open up possibilities of doing something that the other person didn't know about, okay? So once a secret life is created in the affair, then they work very hard to maintain it, okay? And they say things in maintaining it, they say things like, stay out of my private life. If you've ever heard somebody, you know, talk about their private life, okay? So the betraying spouse, the person that's having the affair, often gets very defensive about questions into their private life. And, you know, they begin to do things like, you know, I've known people that have had affairs that have had a secret cell phone. That's a common thing these days. Get a cell phone that is completely separate from your regular cell phone, the only cell phone that your spouse knows about. And so you have this secret phone or, you know, in, you know, a separate email account or, you know, or texting, those kinds of things, where if the, you know, spouse starts to ask questions, you know, I saw something on the computer. The computer was open and I saw something in an email of yours. Hey, what are you doing? Stay out of that's private. Stay out of that private, you know, that somehow the person gets defensive going, you've intruded into my private life. And then the other person almost gets put on the defensive going, I'm really, really sorry. The reality is, when we're married, should either one of us have a private life? A life that is hidden from the other person. Now, there's stuff in my job that's confidential. Karen understands that. She gets that. But there is no part of my life that I would ever say to Karen, well, that's a private part of my life. That's a part of my life you have no right to see. So quit spying on that part of my life. So the idea of stay out of my private life is a red flag right there. Harley says, privacy isn't something that improves marriages. It's honesty and openness that improves marriages. So the question is, Does your spouse, if you're married, does your spouse have access to your emails? My spouse knows the password to my email account and my Facebook account. Does your spouse have access to all that kind of stuff? Karen knows the code to unlock my cell phone. If she wanted to read my texts, all she'd have to do sometimes is grab my phone after I go to bed and, you know, open it up and read the texts. And so there's nothing, there's no part of my life that I want to be hidden from her. Now, she doesn't go snooping. Again, we honor that with the other person. But it isn't, the question is there any reason why you wouldn't want your spouse to see those things? Legitimate reason. Or would you be worried? And a lot of that is, a lot of times Facebook stuff is people contacting people from the past and that kind of stuff and going, part of preventing affairs and preventing going down these paths, these one thing that leads to another, is just making sure we don't have a private life separate from our spouse. One of the things that Karen and I have, and I would highly recommend this if you're married and you don't have this, is the Find My iPhone app on your phone. So that Karen and I both have that. So at any given moment, Karen could open up her phone and see exactly where I am. And so if she looked it up right now, she would think I'm in my office because that's where my phone is. But there is no time that I could go somewhere that Karen wouldn't know that she wouldn't have the ability to know because she can always just open her phone and see where I am. Which is great accountability for stuff like this. It's also just really, really helpful. So if she's driving home on the tollway and, I want to know about where she is, but I don't want to bother her while she's driving, I can just look on that app and see where she is. This week, she was in Chicago in one of the suburbs and got caught in a traffic jam. And she called me and said, I'm at this intersection here. There's a ramp to get on 294 South, but I don't know if I should or not. That's not the normal way I normally come home. What should I do? Well, I pulled up the Find My, I pulled it up, and I could see exactly where she is in that moment. And I just said, yep, take the left right now and take that. And so I was able to direct her. So there's a lot of uses for that. But it would, for me, it would raise yellow flags if a husband or a wife ever said to me, I don't want my spouse to have access to know where I am at all times. That would raise some questions. Why wouldn't you want to? Okay, so, I don't have a secret email account. I don't even have a separate email account. I have one email account that I have here at work, and fortunately, my employer allows me to use that for personal email as well, and so I just have one email. If my employer didn't allow me to use that for personal email, I would have two emails account, and Karen would have the password to both of those. Okay, so we put things in place to make sure we don't go down paths that we don't want to. Another thing that to maintain the secret life that you hear people saying is, I'm disappointed you don't trust me. We put the other person on the defensive, or other colorful language that you may use that's more, harsh than I'm disappointed that you don't trust me, okay? That puts the betrayed spouse on the defensive, feeling guilty and even more hesitant to ask in the future. Where were you last night? Because you came home late and you said you were going to do, but and so where were, were you... can't believe you don't trust me. I told you where I was, and puts the other person on the defensive and makes them more hesitant to ask in the future, okay? So that's kind of a yellow flag when the other person says that. Sometimes you'll hear one of the things that they'll say, and this is, again, part of maintaining the secret life, is they'll just say, I can't remember, Okay, well, where were you last night? Where were you after work last night? Yesterday was a really busy day. I don't remember all that stuff, okay? Here's what we know about the human mind. We remember the stuff that we did very easily. We don't remember stuff that we made up very easily. We don't remember lies. So tomorrow, if you ask me, hey, what did you do yesterday, Gordy? I would go, yesterday was Tuesday. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. So I came to the office for a while. I actually left and got some gas because I knew I was going to be driving to Chicago. Then I remember I had to film some promotional pieces for another church that I'm going to be doing some speaking at, and they asked me to do that. And then I left. I had to go. I drove to Wheaton. I picked my son up from college and brought him home for Thanksgiving vacation. And I got home and then came back to church and got ready for Marriage Matters and taught that last night. If a week from now you said to me, Gordy, where were you a week ago last Tuesday? It may take me a minute, But as soon as I put those pieces together, oh yeah, that was the day I went to pick Grayson up and that was the day I had Marriage Matters, I would be able to lay those details out almost in the exact same order for you perfectly, because it's not hard to remember something that you actually did. If I had made up a story for you about what I did yesterday, and a week later you asked me, what did you do a week ago Tuesday, I might get a lot of those things confused and totally miss some stuff, because our brains just don't work the same way when we make stuff up versus what we do. So when somebody says, when somebody's asked about details and they said, I can't remember all those details, Harley says that to maintain a secret life, the betrayer often prefers to provide little information or details. And so if the person says, I can't remember, it should also send up some red flags for us as well. Sometimes you'll hear them say, oh, we're just friends. No, there is nothing to worry about. We are just friends. That probably was true at some point before the affair. And it's often hard to distinguish, because often lovers in an affair in public would do the same thing that friends do. They'll have lunch together, they'll sit and talk, they'll be friendly, you know, all those kinds of things. And so that's a challenging one to recognize, but that's often one of the defensive things that somebody will maintaining a secret life will say is, well, we're just friends. And then finally, they might decide to leave for an extended period of time or even move out, and they'll say in those moments, I just need some time to think things through. You know, which really is an excuse, if you think about it, to make the secret life easier. For me to say, I just need to leave this, my normal life, and I'm going to go over here and think things through. What they're really doing is making an excuse to go over here and live in their secret life more easily. Okay. Harley says, when a spouse asks for separation to, quote, think things through or decide how I feel, I usually interpret this as his or her way of getting together with a lover more conveniently. Making the affair. It's actually a move towards the secret life and not what they're saying. Okay, so those are things that the person will say and do to just because of having to make an effort to maintain the secret life. So let's talk for a minute about the illusion of an affair, because an affair is not a real relationship. An affair is an illusion. And you'd think that the person who's having the affair would be wrought with guilt and anxiety the entire time. But it's not true. In fact, there is often a lifting, what appears like a lifting of depression during the affair. Why? Because needs are being met. Those important emotional needs are being met in the affair, okay? And the other person can begin to justify and rationalize all kinds of ways. They may feel like, the person in the affair may feel like, this is a gift from God. This is a sign from God that this is the person that God wants me to be with. This relationship is a gift from God because he knows the tough stuff that I'm going through. And so God has brought this wonderful person into my life. And so, you know, unfortunately, all too often, you'll see two Christians that have an affair and they will spiritually rationalize it. Like God brought the two of us together, okay? And so, you know, this idea that suddenly life is going better, there's a lifting of depression, the needs are being met, it feels to them like life is going really well right now. Do you remember back, you know, way back to dating days, do you remember when you were first dating somebody, when you were at that infatuation stage, and life just seemed better? They'd walk in the room and your heart would flutter and you'd think about them all day long, and life was just, you were just kind of floating along because of that infatuation. Well, part of the affair is an infatuation, part of the relationship as well, all right? The other part of the illusion is that an affair is only designed around spending time together doing the things that meet each other's needs. You know, Harley points out in his book that, you know, an affair is a very limited amount of time. Just to be able to maintain a secret life and to have, you know, some moments of time with the other person, those times are usually very, very limited in time. And so if you're limited in the amount of time that you have to be with that person, you're going to use that time really, really well. And Harley says you take that time and you completely focus the time on meeting each other's needs, those needs that are talked about in those two lists, okay? And so it's a life and a relationship that's free from the cares of everyday world and all the other stuff that we have to take care of and manage in our lives. The affair doesn't include any of that stuff. And so it's basically conflict-free by design. Because if you're if you're trying to maintain an affair on a very limited amount of time, you're not going to waste time with conflict and having to deal with it. And so you figure out how to make the relationship conflict-free for those moments. And then it's also designed, because it's limited to just the meeting of needs, it's actually designed to maximize their feelings of love for each other. And so it's not a real relationship. It's an illusion. It's an illusion that's crafted through limited amounts of time, focused on the meeting of needs, basically conflict-free, that is a relationship that is designed around the illusion of a relationship that's actually a real relationship, but it's not, all right? In fact, it's often the assumption that it is a love so strong that the two people begin to think we were meant to be together. You know, this is a love that could weather any storm. This is, you know, and they begin lying to themselves, things like, this is stronger than the love that I had for my spouse. I love this person more than I ever have anybody in the world. And again, they're caught up in the illusion of not a real relationship, and so the feelings of love are distorted and everything else. And Harley says, if that affair gets to the point where, and in that secret life, where the betraying spouse actually separates, whether one or both of them separate from their spouses, he said, with that separation from your real family, from your real marriage, comes reality. And when the affair relationship now incorporates everyday life, because over here in my real world was everyday life, the affair was just this little kind of window of time. If I leave my real life and just focus on the affair, which means probably move in and begin to do life, all life together, that bursts the bubble of the illusion, and now we're dealt with reality. And then everything changes. And what we know to be true is that couples who then get married out of the affair, they met through an affair, they get divorced, whatever is needed, and then they get married themselves. Couples whose marriages started out as affairs almost always end in divorce. Did you know that? Those marriages almost never last. And there's two reasons why. First of all, the affair was an illusion and marriage is reality. And the second is, if you think about it, both people in that new marriage have already proven themselves to be unfaithful to their spouses. They've already proven, I'm a person who is willing to be unfaithful to my spouse. You experienced that from me before? That's who you married. And so very often, that's a pattern that will continue even in that new marriage. So couples whose marriages, and often, you know, couples in an affair will feel like, this is the person I'd rather be married to. And if they actually go to that length, get divorced and marry that person, that marriage almost always fails, all right? So now the question is, how should an affair end? And maybe, you know, maybe there's someone in here that's the situation you're in right now, and you're having an affair, and you're a little bit nervous right now, and sweaty palms. And if you, when you get to the point where you realize this is an affair, this is a relationship that is wrong and it needs to end, now the question is how you do that. Or if you're walking somebody else through it, maybe you've got a friend who's in that situation. This is really helpful information to know. And my guess is God will put you in a situation where you will actually be able to help somebody walk this through sometime in the future, okay? Now, most affairs die a natural death because of all the stuff that we just talked about. Because it's an illusion and not a real relationship, it takes kind of this natural toll and then dies out, okay? But here's the important thing. The end of an affair should be a total separation. A total separation, okay? This should be obvious. To most of us, this is, you know, blatantly obvious. But keep in mind, it is not obvious to the person who's having the affair, who often tries to maintain some level of contact with their lover, with that person. And that should make sense to us because, remember, there's bonding that happened. There's emotional needs that were met. And so there is this longing to stay connected at some level. Even if I recognize that the affair was wrong, even if I say I'm going to break up and, you know, it's over, there's something in me that still longs to maintain some level of contact with that person because emotional needs were met, because bonds were created, all right? Now, but without total separation, renewal of the affair is very possible. If I'm still in any kind of contact with that person, I'm putting myself in a position where those feelings can all come back and take over again, okay? At the same time, trust cannot be rebuilt with my spouse. How is my spouse supposed to learn to trust me again if she knows I'm still in contact with the person I was having the affair with? And is always wondering what's happening there. So in deference to my spouse, you know, in appreciation for her and recognition of that, I need total separation so that I can begin rebuilding the trust process, okay? Harley says, permanent separation not only helps prevent a renewal of the affair, but is also a crucial gesture of consideration for the betrayed spouse. The second thing to note about ending an affair is that an affair is an addiction and must be treated like one. If you think about that, an affair is like an addiction to a person other than the person you're married to. And those of you that have been through recovery programs for other kinds of addictions and substance abuse, you know that an alcoholic simply doesn't go back to just drinking a little. In fact, an alcoholic doesn't even go back to not drinking but hanging out in the bars. There is a sense, if you're really serious about this was wrong, I'm going to do life differently, what you need is you need total separation, the same way someone who was addicted to something needs separation from what they were addicted to. And like coming out of an addiction, there will be withdrawal symptoms. It's not going to be I'm done, that was fine. But because there has been emotional attachment that was built, and we should understand that. We're not going to feel real sorry for you, but we should be empathetic that we know that this is not an easy thing that you're going through, okay? Harley says, extraordinary precautions must be made to avoid all contact with the lover for life. And that has all kinds of implications. If the two couples were best friends, those two couples don't do anything together anymore. It's just not possible in putting life and marriage back together after an affair, okay? Then the critical one, how to end the affair. Two words, in writing. End the affair, not in person, not on the phone, in writing. And I would even go as far as to say, and that doesn't mean a text. That means the old-fashioned pen and paper in writing, okay? And this will not be intuitive to the person who's had the affair. Again, everything in them feels like they owe it to the person. I've got so much invested in that other person and so much invested in that relationship that I at least owe it to them to sit down and explain to them. And so if I come to the realization that I shouldn't be having this affair, and keep in mind, a lot of times it's not my choice. A lot of times it's I got found out and recognized, yes, I was wrong. Yes, I still want my marriage to be intact. My only choice is to end the affair. Sometimes it's that. Sometimes it is coming to the realization, you know what, that was really wrong and I need to end it. Whatever, there's still something in me as the person who had the affair that feels like I owe it to that person or I need to let them down gently. Think about this, though. Anything else leaves too much room for second-guessing the decision. So if I'm going to end the affair and I decide the best way to do it, the gallant way to do it, would be to take the person to the favorite little hidden restaurant that we always went to anyway and sit at our favorite table and sit across from each other like we always did. And then I start to tell them, well, we've just opened ourselves up to all of the, can you imagine we're back in our favorite restaurant with the candle lit and all that kind of stuff, and I'm going to have that conversation with them and it's going to somehow go well? Without them, I mean, you got to keep in mind, everything in them, they're not coming going, oh, okay, that's probably a good idea. We probably should end this relationship. They're so invested in it, they're thinking, no, I want to keep this going. And so to do anything, in person or even on the phone, it just opens up all those possibilities. Just hearing that person's voice again, I'll begin to second guess the decision. And so the best way to do it is in writing. And here's what you say. It was wrong. I love my spouse. I love my wife or my husband. It was wrong to cause the people that I love so much pain. There will be no more contact. Please respect that. And then sign it. Nothing about your feelings for that person. Nothing about, I'll always treasure the memories that we had together. Nothing about, you're a very special person. Nothing that has any potential to raise, to bring those feelings back into it. But just something that is abrupt. It was wrong. I recognize that now. It's over. Please don't contact me anymore. That sounds kind of harsh. It has to be, okay? So nothing else about the past, present, or future. Nothing about I'll miss you, all that kind of stuff. Just end it in writing. And then you must take extraordinary precautions to guarantee that separation. Again, keeping in mind that the person who has had the affair, you know, they may have made the decision to end it, but they're going to fight the feelings that want to rekindle it, that want to see that person, that want to connect. And the other person, maybe it wasn't their decision at all to end it, and they're going to do everything they can to reignite that relationship, okay? So take extraordinary precautions. That may, you know, that can mean changing jobs and relocating. I had a couple one time that I was talking to, and she was having an affair or had ended an affair, knew she needed to end an affair somewhere in that process with a guy that she worked with and kind of for, her supervisor at work. And here was the dilemma. It was a really good job. And she knew that if she left that job, she would probably never find a job that suited her and paid as well as that one did. That was, I recognize that. That was probably true. And so everything in her wanted to stay working there. She wanted to figure out a way that she could stay working there and the affair and still work where she did. And we talked about this, and it's just, it's impossible. It's impossible for her spouse, for her husband to feel like he can begin to rebuild trust with her, knowing that every day she's back in the same work environment with the guy that she was having the affair with. It's too much to ask of her and the guy she was having the affair with to somehow go back to when it was all normal. It's kind of like when you were kids. Remember when you were in high school and you had a boyfriend or girlfriend and you broke up, and the breakup was always like, let's go back to just being friends. And you know that that's not possible, but there's something in you that says it should be. And there's something in us that says it should be possible after an affair to go back to just being friends like we were before. And you know, let's be real about that, all right? Second is blocking all communication with the other person, with the lover. Keep in mind, that person is not necessarily going to be friendly to this idea. And so it may mean a new phone. At the very least, it's, you know, blocking the caller on your cell phone. It's definitely giving your spouse all access to all email and phone records. It could mean a restraining order if it comes to that. But here's the rule of thumb. Do whatever it takes. Do whatever it takes to block all communication with that person. Anything short of that is too risky. The third thing you need to do is account for time. You need to make sure that with your spouse, that your spouse knows where you are, what you're doing at all times. And the critical thing for that is it destroys, you're trying to destroy the secret life and eliminate that secret life, okay? And I'll just say this is true for us men. It's just less natural for us as men to give details about our day. We just need to be more intentional about that, okay? And that's true whether there's an affair involved or not. The fourth is accounting for money, because part of the secret life, there were expenses that went with the secret life. So very, you know, very probably part of the secret life was creating the secret money or money that got funneled to the secret life. And so part of, you know, the recovery process is maintaining an accounting for money with each other in the family, down to the penny. And then fifth is spending all of your leisure time together. so that you don't have this independent life where he plays softball three nights a week and she does this two nights a week, and that, you know, there's all these amounts of time that they need to, in their non-working hours, be spending most of that time together. One, because it eliminates the secret life, but also because you're beginning to rebuild the parts of the relationship that needed rebuilding in the first place, all right? And then setting the stage for recovery in the marriage. This may surprise you, but if you think about it, it makes sense. The betraying spouse, the person who had the affair, often doesn't feel remorse. We would think they, once they get found out and once they get caught, they would feel horrible and guilty and shameful about all that they've done. But it's not necessarily true. In fact, because everything that we said, they may have felt like life was taken on some newness and some goodness because of the affair and because of the illusion of that relationship. And so getting found out doesn't necessarily lead to all kinds of guilt. Whereas the betrayed spouse is waiting for them to feel guilty and to express remorse, to walk across the room on their knees, preferably across broken glass, going, "I am so, so sorry." But maybe sorry isn't what they're feeling. And so already there's a conflict in the rebuilding of the marriage, because the one spouse is kind of waiting for and expecting the other person to feel so guilty and so sorry, while the other person is going through the withdrawal of the relationship being broken up. And so that may not happen the way the betrayed spouse is hoping, okay? The betraying spouse, the spouse who had the affair, may be wanting to move forward on rebuilding the marriage, while the betrayed spouse is focusing on the affair. And this is a very common occurrence, okay? So once the affair gets found out and they decide they're going to break off the affair and work at putting the marriage back together, very often the person who had the affair is wanting to say, okay, let's move forward. Let's talk about the marriage. Let's move where we're going. Whereas the person that was on the betrayed side of it goes, whoa, time out. They want to know more about the affair. They want more details about the affair, okay? What happened? The specifics of when and where and how, and was it our bedroom, and which body parts went where? And they're wanting the betraying spouse to somehow pay. And so I want to talk more about the affair. I want you to feel guilty, all that kind of stuff. And it's very natural to want to know the details, because they can't get the affair out of their mind. This is the person that was betrayed, the other spouse. They can't get the affair out of their mind, and they're trying to imagine what and where and when. And so they want details. And here's what I would say, and I would say this to you if you've been a spouse who has been betrayed by a spouse who's had an affair, or if you are helping walk somebody through this process. The person who has been betrayed longs for details, and I would say this: you have every right to know all the details, but you may not want to. You may want to rethink that one. Because those details become images etched in your brain, and you will never get rid of them. When I was in college, I remember one time my dad called me, and I was trying to think of this today. I do not even remember the circumstances around this conflict I had with my dad. I don't remember what the issue was. Obviously, we had had some kind of a conversation that didn't go well, and he was mad at me for something I did or said. And then I remember one day he called me, which was shortly after. We only talked about once a week because it was expensive back then. But he called me like the next day, and he said, "I've got a favor." And I could just tell in his voice there was something wrong. And he was kind of quiet, and he said, "I've got a favor to ask of you." And unlike any other favor I've ever asked, Gordy, he said, "I got off the phone with you last night. I was really, really angry. I wrote a letter to you, and I mailed it." And he said, "As I think about it, I said things in that letter that I deeply regret. I don't want you to see them." And he said, "I'm asking you, I'm begging you, when that letter comes in the mailbox, please, please do not open it. Throw it away. And I don't remember how that conversation ended. And he said, I know I can't make you. I'm just asking you. And I remember about 3 days later, which is about what mail took back then, I go to my mailbox in the College Union, and I open it, and there's and here's this letter from my dad. And I recognize his handwriting, and I know this is it. And I almost start shaking with it. And you know that I was curious, right? I was dying to know what he wrote that he regretted so much. And everything in me wanted to open that letter. And then I thought about it, and I thought, I deserve to know what's in this letter. This is my letter. I can open this letter. I have every right to open this letter. And I think I was right in thinking that. And I don't know what made me do this in the moment. I don't know what came over me. But I honored my dad's request and I threw the letter away. And I never opened it. And 40 years later, I can't tell you how glad I am that that was the decision I made. Because I don't even remember what the conflict was about. I've forgotten all of that. But I guarantee you this, if I had opened that letter that day 40 years ago and read it, I would still be able to tell you today what that letter said. Those words, those images would have been tattooed in my brain. And I think it's the same way when it comes to details around an affair. There's something in you that wants to know the details, that feels so betrayed. You have a right to know the details. I just don't know if you want to. Because those images, any of the details that you hear, will become etched in your brain, and you will never, ever forget those. And I think that will be more destructive, and it will add to the destructiveness of the affair just continuing on down the road. So be very, very careful about that, all right? And then recovering from the affair. And what I want to do is talk about what Harley talks about is four rules for guiding marital recovery. And these are really great principles for a marriage, even if affair isn't involved. These are great things that will help on the prevention side of an affair. So for all relationships, for all marriages, these are great rules to guide, all right? And these are rules to be followed by both spouses, the betrayer and the betrayed spouse. It's not just one. We're not, you know, it's not one person's responsibility to put the marriage back together after an affair. It really is for both people. It requires both people working together, all right? So it's not something that one person has to do because the affair was their fault, that kind of a deal, all right? So here's the first one. The first one is the rule of protection. The rule of protection. Avoid being the cause of your spouse's unhappiness, Harley says. Because if you've ever been in that situation, you know that there is a temptation to inflict pain back on the betraying spouse. You have experienced pain at a level that you didn't know a human could experience, and there's something in you that wants to inflict pain back on that person, a payback of some sense. Let them know how it feels, okay? While at the same time, the betraying spouse, the person who had the affair, wants to remind the other person how they failed to meet their most important needs that led to the affair. And so there's a battle that goes on just in terms of this. So Harley says just really work at not being the cause of your spouse's unhappiness. While it feels natural, inflicting pain and punishing our spouse only works to prevent the rebuilding of the marriage, Harley says. And so work to avoid angry outbursts, which is both spouses blaming the other person for the affair, disrespectful judgments, lecturing the other person on how thoughtless they are or thoughtless they were, how they messed up the family, what a jerk they are or were, or other colorful language that you tend to use. Work to avoid making selfish demands. With people feeling like the other person, with both people feel like the other person has lots of making up to do, they're tempted to make demands on the other person. And Harley says, demands do not encourage people to cooperate. If you force your spouse to meet your needs, it becomes a temporary solution at best, and resentment is sure to rear its ugly head, he says, okay? The rule of protection here is so important because at this point, the relationship is so fragile that both people in the relationship must do everything that they can to not make matters worse by hurting the other person. So work at avoid being the cause of your spouse's unhappiness, the rule of protection. And then the second is the rule of care. Meet your spouse's most important emotional needs. Care for the other person. And this goes back again to that list that you have on your page and that we talked about of the five emotional needs for men and women. And so go back and identify the other person's most important emotional needs. And then the question is, what could you do more intentionally to meet those needs for that person? Okay, and you can go back and listen to that teaching, look at those notes again to get more information on that one. The third one, letter C, is the rule of time. The rule of time. Harley says, take time to give your spouse your undivided attention. Okay, and again, I remind us that we mastered this as dating couples. We were great at dating couples at finding time to just be with them in undivided attention. And that sometimes we lose that completely in a marriage, and sometimes that's what leads down the road to the divorce. Three keys to making this rule work, the rule of time with each other, undivided attention. One is privacy, which means without the kids, without other couples, it's not a group thing. And it's face-to-face. It means conversation, not just going to a movie and sitting and watching a movie together. That there is objectives. Harley says, focus your time on the activities that will meet these four needs: affection, sexual fulfillment, conversation, and recreational companionship. And if you don't recognize what those are the two top emotional needs for both men and women. Okay, so focus there. When it comes to the amount of time, this may floor you, but Harley suggests spending 15 hours a week as a couple. And that's in marriages that are already fairly satisfying to both people, where you both feel like, well, the marriage was pretty good before. He says, in this restoration process, spend 15 hours of undivided attention time a week doing that, okay? And then he says, and more time if the marriage was not mutually satisfactory before that, okay? Again, that sounds like a lot. Where are we going to come up with 15 hours a week to just focus on each other here? Well, again, go back to dating. We figured that out then. We need to kind of figure that out again. And for those of you that, you know, this may seem like this, you know, vast amount of time just to put a marriage back together. Those of you that have been through recovery, you know that in the early stages of recovery, the first 40 or 60 days of recovery, you're often at a group every single night. That you devote every bit of free time that you have to working on the recovery. And it's the same for in a recovery in a marriage. That's what you focus on with all of your free time for a given period of time. And then finally, letter D is the rule of honesty. Be totally open and honest with your spouse. As we said before, all affairs require dishonesty. It's just a part of the thing. You know, an honest relationship between a husband and a wife makes an affair almost impossible. If you have a truly honest relationship between a husband and a wife, an affair is almost impossible. And so we need to rebuild honesty back into the relationship. Emotional honesty. Talk honestly about your feelings, both positive and negative. Own your own feelings. We've talked about that a lot here in Marriage Matters and Rebuilders. About the events of your life. Especially about your feelings about things that your spouse says and does. Get better at honestly communicating about how you're doing and feelings about what the other person says. Historical honesty. Reveal information about your personal history, especially events that demonstrate your failures and weaknesses. Now, keep in mind, the week we talked about sexuality and the growth of intimacy in a relationship, remember how we said intimacy gets cut off? Some of what you're doing here is you're rebuilding intimacy that may never have even been there. And you're building that into that with honesty about failures and weaknesses, all that kind of stuff. Again, note, this is not a detailed accounting of your past sexual experiences. I think there needs to be honesty about your past relationships. But again, not details that then become painful and negative memories and images in your spouse's mind. So again, be careful about the details that you share, although I think you should be honest about the extent of past relationships and sexuality for your spouse. Current honesty. Readily reveal information about the events of your day. Begin talking about what's going on right now in your day and with you personally and in your feelings. Share calendars with details of when and where you're going to be and who you're meeting with. In other words, you're basically pulling the cover off of a secret life, and now we're moving back into full disclosure on everywhere I'm going, everybody I'm with, all that kind of stuff. And so it's almost like building new muscle memory for avoiding going down the road of a secret life again. Future honesty. Talk about your thoughts and plans and dreams and goals with each other. And then, you know, complete honesty. Don't leave any false impressions with your spouses. Don't say anything that is said in a deceptive manner or to stretch the truth. We talked about that before. Do not deliberately keep personal information from your spouse. All right. Some final thoughts. Healing the pain. I know that there probably is no pain in a relationship, you know, few pains that a human can experience that is as deep as the pain of betrayal of a spouse who has had an affair. I understand that. But it is possible to heal. And I know so many people that have said, I will never, ever get over this. It would be impossible for me to get over it. That's not true. It is possible to heal the pain. Now, and it's a wound that needs to be healed. Okay? And like other wounds, there will always be scar tissue. Doesn't mean that getting over it and being healed from it is the removal of the memory of it. You will always have some scar tissue. But the pain can go away. I've had several surgeries, and I could show you the scar tissue from the surgery. That scar tissue will always be there, a reminder to me that that was a part of my story. But there's no more pain. It's possible for the pain to go away, even though the scar tissue will remain, okay? I think the best way to describe this, it's like a weld on a broken piece of metal. If you've ever welded anything or had anything welded, when I was a little kid, I remember we had a lawnmower that I remember one time the handle, I don't know if it was my fault probably, but it broke. And the handle was just broken in half about halfway down the handle, which means the lawnmower obviously didn't work very well. And my dad, who was fairly cheap and didn't want to buy a new lawnmower, and wanted to teach me a lesson, we loaded up the lawnmower into our station wagon and we drove it to the welding shop in town. And he knew the welder and he went up to the welder, the guy that owned that business, and he said, my lawnmower is broken and we need to weld it up here. And so the guy welds it and he welded the handle back together and it was just kind of this ugly weld, just kind of looked like a knob there, this weld. And my question, I was just a little kid, the question was, well, won't it break again there? And he pulled me, Sonny, come here. He goes, you could break this handle almost anywhere you want to. It will never break there again. And he said, this part of the weld, right now where I just welded it, that is now the strongest part of the handle. That you can rebuild a marriage, and it's like welding two pieces of metal back together. You'll have some scar tissue, and it's a part of your story that you won't ever forget. But the marriage can be stronger because of it. And I could bring people in here that I've talked to that have said, yes, that's true for us. Now, it doesn't mean I'm glad we went through it. There's not a part of me that was glad that we went through it. But our marriage is so much stronger because we went through it. Not because we went through the affair, but because we went through the process of rebuilding the marriage after the affair. If you will weld the marriage back together, if you put a marriage back together after an affair, the marriage can survive, the marriage can grow, the marriage can actually be stronger because of the recovery process than it was even before the affair. All right? And then finally, hope for the betrayer. If you're somebody that has been on that side of it and you've had an affair and you've been living with all the guilt and shame of that and you wonder if that, you know, can ever go away or if that's just, you just have to live, you made your bed, you got to lie in it. You have to live with this guilt and shame the rest of your life. I want to remind you that when Jesus died on the cross, he died for that too. And he died to pay the penalty for the sin. He also died to remove the guilt and shame. That God is able to forgive you for that and wants to forgive you for that and wants to release you from the guilt and the shame that you carry. But you need to forgive yourself. And we're going to talk about that next week. Because if God has forgiven you, which I believe that he has, if you've asked, through Jesus' death on the cross, if God has forgiven you, then no one is served and nothing is served in your life because you won't forgive yourself. In fact, your lack of forgiveness for yourself is holding you back, and it's holding back the people that you love. And there is grace. God wants you to experience the freedom of His grace and the freedom of new life, regardless of what you've done in the past, and to live life free from all that guilt and shame. And then I end with one question today. It's a question that I get frequently. How do you forgive someone that has hurt you so badly? How do you, on the betrayed side, get to the point, can you get to the point, and how do you get to the point where you can forgive someone that has hurt you so, so badly? And we're going to talk about that next week.